Hi, I'm Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine.
Hi, I'm Kashmir Hill. I'm a staff writer at Forbes magazine.
And tell us the name of your blog at Forbes.
I write about privacy issues and technology, and my page is called The Not-So-Private Parts.
Right, and we've got a bunch of privacy-themed topics today. And let's start by talking about Google Glasses, which has been something that's going around the web. There have been I guess there's a demonstration video by Google of a Google Glasses concept where you'd basically be wearing what look like just a pair of relatively plain glasses, but you will sort of see things on a screen and also be looking out at the world. And there were a couple of spoofs that basically said, look at all the ads that are going to be popping up in your field of vision and making your whole life into a dystopian commercialist nightmare. But you had a different take, a more straightforward take on the Google Glasses, and you thought that Google Glasses basically make a surveillance state inevitable. Is that right?
Right. So Google Glasses are the newest invention out of Google X, which is kind of Google's secret lab where they make science fiction novels come to life.
Right.
And it basically takes your, you know, your smartphone screen and just puts it right in front of your eyes. So you're constantly experiencing both reality and then your augmented kind of internet reality. What I think is interesting about this is that if you have a camera on your glasses and it's constantly streaming, it means that you could constantly be recording everything that you're seeing. So a lot of there are a lot of people out there that love the idea of life logging or quantifying the self, and for them it means they could just record everything and have just this running record of everything that's happened. They could go back to, you know, 3 years ago and see exactly what they were seeing. But the other kind of aspect of this is that if you're recording everything that's happening all the time, that means you can play back anything that you see. And so that could be really useful for police investigations. They could have, if something happened in a given area, they could, you know, use GPS tracking to figure out who was there and then,
right,
you know, subpoena the vision logs from the people that were in the area to see what happened. For, you know, normal everyday citizens, if we just see something embarrassing happen, or something really interesting or inspiring, you could, you know, tell your Google Glasses to save the last 3 minutes, and then you could just immediately upload that to Twitter. So we'll start, you know, living, we could potentially start living in a world where everything is literally being recorded all the time. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, if you think about the Trayvon Martin investigation, for example, I mean, it would be
right,
a completely different investigation if all of the neighbors were wearing Google Glasses, or, you know, if Zimmerman and Martin themselves had been wearing Google Glasses. You
right,
know exactly what happened, and I think that is going to be pretty appealing to people as a feature.
Huh. Yeah, it seems like it's especially, well, from my perspective, worrisome and definitely a dramatic change when you combine it with facial recognition technology so that it's not only these fraught moments when there's maybe a crime that happens or something that or something embarrassing happens that become fodder for this private moment becoming a public one, but it's also just, you know, any interaction. You're walking down the street, and if this is all uploaded to the cloud, you can imagine the future Facebook feature where you just have people, you have people's faces being tagged of who you saw in the crowd, and people can be identified. Oh, you were here at this particular day and time. It seems like we already have the facial recognition software. We're apparently soon going to have Google Glasses. And so the last bit of technology that we don't have, at least right now, in a feasible form to make it happen, I guess, is data storage, right?
Right, right. And so that would be a question, I guess a privacy question, as this became a reality, is how do you handle storage? Does it go into, you know, a cloud like our email? Do we all have a, you know, a kind of our personal servers that we're storing it on for mm-hmm. to be more privacy protective? Increasingly, we seem to be pretty happy to put everything in the cloud. I kind of don't imagine that everybody would want to have this recording all the time and to save everything. one kind of privacy protective measure that I suggested is that, you could have it so it's just recording the last 5 minutes and it records over that over and over again, or the last hour, or the last day,
right.
So that you don't actually have this really explicit log of your life for anyone to hack or subpoena.
Right, but of course this protects people from themselves, but not from one another.
Right. You can't control other people's privacy settings, which is a problem,
right.
With all kinds of technology.
Right. Well, and presumably it's precisely the embarrassing moment you have that you don't want other people to see when they're most likely to to stop their 5-minute stream and say, save that, and share it on Reddit, as you wrote about in another piece about people sharing embarrassing moments on, I guess, content aggregators, social networks, what have you.
There's this really interesting science fiction novel called The Quantum Thief, and in it there's this planet where everyone has an internal device. I think it's called a Jevulet, and in any kind of interaction you have with another person, before the interaction happens, you get to set your privacy settings. It's kind of journalistic in a way. You can say whether the interaction is going to be on the record, if it's going to be on background, so that you can remember that the interaction happened, but you won't be able to remember who with. It's kind of like a wonderful idea. And increasingly, I feel like it's something I wish that kind of science fiction invention could come into reality.
Well, my instinct is that if that were our reality, that everyone would default to off the record, right? I mean, there would probably be small communities of people that defaulted in an activist way to on the record, but I think most people would default to off the record, and you would have the same kind of problem that you have now in journalism, in Washington journalism, where, everyone is always talking off the record, and it's just become accepted that you identify yourself as a senior administration official because it's what everyone does and it comes to be expected, and all the problems that go along with that. I mean, do you think differently? Do you think people would actually make conscious decisions in every individual interaction that they had?
Well, I would say, we could look at Facebook privacy settings, and there are many people who choose, the most public settings there to expose their information to anybody. It's kind of a smaller subset that actually choose to, limit limit their content just to their friends or just to friends
true.
Of friends. And so that might be, another way that could go.
Do you think that in a world of Google Glasses and God only knows what other innovations that come along, privacy settings and individual decisions are going to drive the norms? Or do you think enough people – or do you think there – my instinct is that with something as radically different as a lot of people wearing something like Google Glasses, there are going to be enough incidents that cause people to demand that the government step in and legislate privacy settings of some sort or legislate privacy norms. I mean, of course, there are already examples of this. Wiretapping is illegal, for example, in different states. There are different rules about recording conversations and what have you. But I can't imagine that people are going to let government are going to let congressmen stay out of this. I think that they're going to demand, I want various privacy protections, maybe in a way that is a reaction to extreme cases, in the same way that we somehow sometimes have child protection laws, for example. We'll have the, so-and-so's law of privacy protection.
Yeah, I think Facebook is a really interesting case study for this in terms of, one, you have kind of Facebook setting certain privacy expectations in the way that they design their product. And then you have user pushback when something violates our expectations. And then you also have government involvement with the FTC, with their recent settlement with Facebook and kind of creating certain expectations, and they're going to be monitoring them. So it's not the easiest or best answer, but I think it's going to continue to be that kind of here in Washington. Here in Washington, they call it the multi-stakeholder process. But I think that's what it's going to continue to be, like what our expectations are, what companies offer us as options, which is kind of the biggest determiner of the amount of privacy that we have, and then, you know, some amount of government pushback, specifically from the FTC.
And I'm afraid that the government pushback is going to be worse on average than your than the typical piece of legislation that passes, because I think that there's this problem of politicians generally being on the older side of the population, mm-hmm. and technology changing so quickly that the people who understand these products the best are not going to be the people that are making the rules.
Right. I think that's a big problem. And we keep seeing it in these technology hearings where they don't have any engineers there to offer kind of true expertise. And I think part of it is, you know, you read my blog, but I blame the media a lot for creating kind of privacy fears. I think sometimes that companies deserve to be called out for certain practices, but I think other times they get called out for doing something nefarious when it really was just an engineering decision to make a product work better. I think it'd be better for privacy if we are a little bit more careful in terms of what we call out.
Yeah, I often agree with you in specific instances. I also think that this is a case where you have so many different users of so many different levels of sophistication, especially mm-hmm. when something like Facebook goes from being something on college campuses to something that people's grandparents are signing up for. And I think we also have this fiction. We operate in this environment where we're regularly called upon to read these ridiculous terms of use statements on sites that are, you know, the other day I had to, you know, read yet another iTunes terms of use service agreement when I went to buy a single song.
And it's like all 43 pages.
Yeah. It's like, no, I'm not going to read 43 pages, to buy this new Jay-Z single. That's ridiculous. There's no possible, you know, and it could say anything. Who knows what I've agreed to, but it's just, there is no time to read these statements, and I wonder if also there's going to be legislation at some future date about limiting in some way or having some kind of default so that we're not operating under the absurd conceit that we're all reading all of these things and agreeing to them and we're all having this informed transaction.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be tons of people who, you know, buy Google Glasses and start using them, and then, right. you know, 5 years in, they're like, oh my gosh, I have 5 years of my life has been recorded and, you know, advertisers have access to it and the police can come and like, look what I did 3 years ago. I'm sure that will happen. As to whether the government's, the Federal Trade Commission has said, you know, has been kind of pushing companies to shorten their privacy policies, to be more upfront about their practices. And I think that's kind of sinking in. A lot of companies mm-hmm. are talking about privacy by design, where you actually design these products in a way, that kind of, they say bait, that you bake privacy in. And I think that's kind of sinking in. I don't know if at some point there's going to be some really big, kind of legislative kick. There's certainly a lot of talk about it, but nothing seems to be
moving
very quickly here.
Yeah, I also keep expecting there to be some company that's going to come out and say, you know, use our email service. We're going to commit up front to never selling your data, to having extremely high privacy settings. We're going to basically give you the opposite trade-off that you make using Google or using Facebook. And it hasn't happened yet, as far as I know.
Well, there's an interesting company that your colleague Alexis Madrigal wrote about recently called Privly. It's a startup where I think it's interesting because it will allow you to keep using Gmail and Facebook and Twitter, but they basically encrypt your communication so that Facebook, Twitter, and Google can't actually read your communications. They're encrypted and only somebody with the key can see them. And so it's an interesting way to keep using those services, but to make your communications private. The problem is it's an extra step. And for a lot of people, convenience is kind of outweighs their need for privacy.
Well, and it's also something that only a minority of users can ever do, right? Or else the whole Gmail business model doesn't work.
Right.
So, well, let's move on to this case about a Boston College football player. It's named Jared Rudolph, and he was charged with audio taping a consensual sexual encounter between one of his teammates and a female grad student. And I see that he may face criminal charges, and he's been suspended from the team. And you were fascinated by this story. Tell us a little bit about why it interests you.
Well, I thought this was really interesting, especially coming on the heels of the Tyler Clementi case and Darun Ravi being found guilty of, you know, invasion of privacy and hate crimes for right. for secretly videotaping his roommate. In this case, it wasn't really a secret videotaping. So these football players like live in the same suite. You have one football player in the common room and one of his roommates, you know, in his bedroom with his girlfriend having very loud sex. And apparently, you know, they're college kids. This football right. player thought it was funny. He just records it with his cell phone and then sends the sound file around. And the right. the woman, who is a grad student, found out about it when people started making fun of her. Mm-hmm. And she got a lawyer and reported to the police. But I was going back and forth with a privacy lawyer friend of mine about like whether this is a true privacy violation. In that, I think it's complicated because you're in this common space, you're hearing mm-hmm. ambient noise. You know, you record that ambient noise and you're then broadcasting it. I mean, is that an invasion of privacy, or are you kind of just broadcasting, projecting your own experience?
Right.
I think it's a really complicated privacy question in this day and age when we all have like this very sophisticated surveillance device because we have our phones.
Yeah, it's certainly an instance where we treat technology different than the real world. And what I mean by that is, had he went out into his hallway and called a bunch of people into the common room, and, you know, pointed to the closed door and said, ha ha, listen, my roommate's having loud sex, certainly it wouldn't have been anything he could be criminally charged for, nor is it something that probably he would have been suspended for.
Or if he wrote a memoir about, you know, his year as a BC football player, and he wrote about the fact that his roommate and his roommate's girlfriend had really loud sex all year and, like, kind of detailed it. And then
right, even if he included a photo of her and her home address, and you know, you can imagine a way that he would write about it that would be a more extreme invasion of privacy, mm-hmm. but where he would not be legally culpable. At the same time, I guess to play devil's advocate, maybe the difference here and the reason for these rules is that there's a permanence to. The audio file that there wouldn't be to calling friends into a room, though there would be, I guess, to a memoir.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting pieces of this is that one of the charges that's been raised is that Massachusetts is a two-party consent state. So to record mm-hmm. a conversation with somebody, you have to have their consent. So, I mean, my immediate reaction to that was, like, is this really a conversation that you're recording or are you just right. intercepting noise?
Right.
Which is not a privacy question, but is kind of a wrinkle in terms of kind of parsing this case.
Right. And it's hard to imagine that he would have been charged had his intention been different. Had he been sitting in the common room recording,
if you were doing a blogging heads and you could hear this in the background.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Then this would be captured in the same way. And yet it's hard to imagine that he would have been charged. I don't know if the legal question would have turned on intention at all. I suppose not. But
I mean, I kind of feel like she has a civil case. There's kind of like an emotional, intentional infliction of emotional harm. I just don't know if this should be a case that's in the criminal courts. And I think right. we're still trying to figure out kind of what invasion of privacy is in the digital age, and what's right. okay and what's not okay. There was this other case of there was some guy at a Burger King, there was a married couple there who were having like a kind of marriage-ending fight, and he started mm-hmm. tweeting it, And he included photos and kind of explicit pieces of their conversation. He even made a video. Right. And it became a huge story. It was on Gawker. ABC News picked it up. And the couple was never identified because we don't have that facial recognition technology yet. But and it was in a public space as opposed to this being in more of a private space in a, you know, a shared home. But they're kind of like similar privacy invasions. And I see them both more as a breach of kind of etiquette and norms. And I'm not sure if they should be illegal.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing to me is the way that, you know, there have been cases recently where people have tried to record police officers while they were on the job, and they've been charged, citizens have been charged under wiretap laws because while it is legal to record video, it was illegal in some states to record audio of police officers or anyone else for that matter.
Is this, again, the two-party consent?
Right. And one interesting thing, I was thinking about that when I was reading about the Google Glasses, because it seems like right now our legal norms treat audio as more protected than video. And I wonder whether that could survive a world of ubiquitous video, because it seems like in a lot of cases, video is the thing one might worry about more. I think I would be more worried about video privacy. I mean, maybe this is partly because I'm someone who is out there with my opinions on the internet every day by virtue of being a journalist. But, if I had to choose between everything that I say being made public or all my actions being made public in video, I think I would rather keep the video private and have the audio be public.
I'm fairly certain that the reason for that is just that these laws date back to a time when there were a lot of technological ways to record audio
and not much around
video. And so they created protections around audio, but not around video. And then the technology, you know, kept going just didn't catch up with the fact that now the cameras are so cheap now. We all have cameras and there are cameras on every corner.
Yeah, another police-related topic I wanted to talk about. There was an article that came out. I'm trying to remember where it was. I think Radley Belko is the one who wrote about it. But in any case, it's about police dogs and how they are in some ways worthless for establishing probable cause. What I mean by that is that, a police officer pulls you over on the side of the road, and my understanding of the law, correct me if I'm wrong, is that, for example, if your trunk is locked, they're not allowed to look in your trunk without probable cause.
Right.
If, however, they bring a police dog to the side of the road and the police dog walks by the trunk and alerts, as if to signify, yes, I smell drugs or a bomb or whatever I've been trained to smell inside of this trunk, that establishes probable cause. And they can open up your trunk and look inside. One of the problems with this, this article states is that, as anyone who has a dog knows, dogs generally want to please their humans. They generally want to please the people that have trained them. They've, evolved over thousands of years to do this. And so on one hand, you have the police officer who kind of suspects that there's something in this car and kind of wants the dog to alert and isn't doing anything wrong. He's just going about his job and seeing if the dog alerts. But he's giving the dog, who is very perceptive, these signals, and it's been found that dogs do alert when the police officer thinks that there's something there, more often than when the police officer doesn't think that there's something there. And of course, you also have the problem of a police officer who is actually not following the spirit of the law and is, doing something that causes the dog to alert and then using that as a pretext. And it seems like the Fourth Amendment is worth nothing if that can happen. And so this seems like an area where we should not, in fact, treat police dogs alerting as probable cause. And you were mentioning something about how in an analogous circumstance, we don't treat it that way if it's not a dog but something else.
Well, what I think is interesting about this is, okay, so the solution for this would probably be to have, like a robotic dog or, maybe not a robotic dog, but like some kind of device you could carry around and it has the same kind of sniffing capacity of a dog and it could pick up on, the presence of something.
Right.
And then you would eliminate this possibility of the officer kind of like cueing the dog, like you'd cue, you know, Mr. Ed or a talking horse.
Right.
But once you have that, coming back to this question of like the technological intervention, there's a Supreme Court case from a few years ago where police had a kind of thermal detection scanner, and so they could use it to like roll past a house and then see if there were any hot spots in the house that indicated that marijuana was being grown. Somebody who was prosecuted using this evidence challenged it and said it was a Fourth Amendment violation, that it's an unreasonable search, that you should have to have, you know, a court order or a warrant to do this. And the Supreme Court did decide that using technology this way was not allowed, and the police are not using this device now. And so, you know, if the dogs were some kind of technological tool, I think that the Supreme Court would probably say that's not allowed. That is a search. And so I am curious how they'll rule on that, whether they will consider dogs to be a technology. And if so, I think it could. I mean, if they were to keep the reasoning from this earlier case, it seems like they would need to decide that dogs shouldn't be allowed unless there's already probable cause.
Yeah, you can imagine this. You can imagine this sci-fi scenario where police start to genetically engineer animals in order to be super sleuths,
or genetically engineer police officers.
Oh wow! Yes. I'm often confounded by the law that surrounds expectation of privacy. Another example that confounds me is cordless phones, where if you're in a house and you're talking about some crime you've committed, the police have to have a warrant to tap your phone and to listen in. On the other hand, if you're talking on a cordless phone and they're sitting in a house next door with a baby monitor that just happens to be the same frequency as your cordless phone and they overhear you, that is considered kosher for Fourth Amendment purposes. And the reasoning is that on a cordless phone, you do not have the same expectation of privacy. I don't know. That just doesn't square with my intuition. It seems to me that people on a cordless phone, that there are some technologically savvy people who understand how it works and that maybe their neighbor can hear them. But for the average person talking on a cordless phone inside their home, they do have an expectation of privacy, at least every bit as much as they would if they were talking on a landline.
Yeah, what's funny about this is like when you go back to like the very old landlines where they were party lines, there's actually, you know, a lower expectation of privacy around landlines than you would have around portable phones. My feeling is that just the law is really still evolving to catch up with these technologies. And you're starting to see it in various court cases, especially around the search of devices upon arrest, like whether police are allowed to, if you're pulled over, whether they're allowed to go through your smartphone and look at your, you know, your email and your contacts and your recent calls and your recent text messages. There's so much information there. There's probably more information there than you would get if you went into that person's house and looked around.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I kind of, in terms of protecting the integrity of people's homes and effects, I think that that's just eventually probably going to be extended to cell phones and smartphones. That's kind of my expectation. I think it's going to take a while, and I think it's going to take younger judges and younger lawyers who really understand these technologies before it does happen.
And it's interesting that we presume that this is going to happen judicially as opposed to legislatively. And why is that? Why is it that it always seems to be judges constraining what can be done, and it's almost never legislatures preempting what can be done or extending protections due to new technology?
I don't know. I don't know if it's just like it's you get enough of these court cases where legislatures realize that they should act.
I don't know. I understand that there's political pressure to be seen as tough on crime and to not do things that are going to open you up to future campaign ads about how you're responsible for the murder of someone or whatever. And yet it seems like there'd be broad popularity around a bill, for example, to protect people's smartphones during traffic stops. It seems like a lot of people have these phones. Everyone sooner or later gets pulled over for having a taillight out or for speeding or whatever. And it seems like most people would want this protection, that it would be a popular thing. Maybe I am just completely out of touch with what my fellow Americans think. Totally possible. I don't know. I'm always surprised that there isn't a push for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I suspect not. I mean, I assume that you get this kind of tug of war between the Department of Justice and kind of civil liberties groups that are pushing for these kinds of protections. There currently is, after there was the Jones case this year out of the Supreme Court around GPS trackers on cars, and the court kind of surprisingly unanimously decided that Jones's Fourth Amendment rights had been violated when the police put a GPS tracker on his car without a warrant. And they pretty much said that law enforcement does need to get a warrant before they can put a tracker in a car, but there are some interpretations of the decision that that might not lead to that. But the Supreme Court basically said, "Hey, Congress, we need a law around this. Like you guys need to step in here." And that's happened a few times now, and Congress it doesn't seem to be listening to what the Supreme Court is saying. There are a few bills that are floating around regarding location privacy and whether law enforcement should need a warrant to be able to see where you are based on your cell phone, whether they wanted to track you in real time or wanted to pull your records, from the last 30 days or years or however long your cell phone provider keeps that. It's called the GPS bill. And it seems like there would be a lot of support for that, but right now it is just sitting there.
Yeah, I suppose the Larry Lessig response to all of this would be, of course, Congress hasn't acted because there is no relevant industry lobby that is pushing them to protect privacy. So even though they may want to do it, even though it may be something they theoretically want to do, even though it may be something that consumers theoretically want. They're ultimately going to focus on the areas that are ripe for sort of divide and conquer political strategy or else getting campaign contributions. I wonder if you're the legislative affairs strategist at Facebook or Google, though, if you don't want to push some sort of privacy legislation on the presumption that it's going to come up eventually and better that you shape it than not, I guess just shape it anyway.
There is actually a group that is pushing for reform of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and they have it's called Digital Commons, and it's they're working with like various civil liberties groups here, Center for Democracy and Technology, and Google is on board, Facebook is on board, AT&T is on board. They all would like ECPA updated just so they kind of have clearer guidance in terms of like when they're supposed to be turning stuff over and when they're not.
Right.
And so you actually saw a lot of a lot of companies and civil liberties groups all kind of together on this issue. And it also hasn't really moved forward. I'm very confused by like what happens.
I am
a few blocks away at the Capitol.
I think that actually the police kind of what are citizens' rights when they're interacting with the police? It seems like the least thorny thing to me actually, or how should companies turn over stuff? Because I guess the harder areas to legislate seem like the case we were talking about earlier, where someone is recording their roommate in a different room, right? Because you can pick these theoretical norms that you want to have, but it's very possible to legislate in a way that seems perfectly reasonable and that it is a compromise that all of the stakeholders accept. And yet, on the ground, 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 and 18 and 19-year-olds are just behaving in radically different ways from the law, and you've suddenly criminalized the behavior of all of these kids who are just, like, breaking the law left and right.
Right.
And some of them are prosecuted with dire consequences for something that everyone is doing, which seems like is what's happening in the Jerry Rudolph case, that, you know, surely everyone of that age has some friend who has recorded someone doing something embarrassing and shared it. And it's just the guy that gets caught that bears the brunt of these changing norms, I guess.
Right.
So there's this recent controversy about a smartphone app called Girls Around Me. And if I understand correctly, you could basically click a little button on your phone and it would show you all of the women around you and a picture that was drawn from their Facebook profile if their Facebook profile was set to public.
Mm-hmm. Or from there. Most people, it was the data, the location data was drawn from Foursquare, and most people have a Foursquare photo. So it came from either Foursquare or if their Facebook profile was connected with their Foursquare account from their Facebook account.
Right. And the general reaction to this was, oh, this is awful. This is, you know, sexual predation or sexual harassment or, infringing upon the privacy of women. And you had a very different reaction to this.
Yeah, so this app has been around for a few months now. It had been downloaded about 70,000 times, according to the creators. And it got a lot of attention after a writer at Cult of Mac did a long piece on it and called it a tool for rapists and stalkers and described how he, demonstrated how to use it to a bunch of his friends at a barbecue. And he described one of his female friends going pale because she was so freaked out by the idea of men being able to see where women who had checked in publicly on Foursquare were at any given time and to get information about them from their Facebook profiles if they were connected. And my take on this, I understood the creepiness of the app. Like the app was designed in such a way that it was like James Bond style kind of naked women posing as silhouettes, like provocatively. And
right.
So you were juxtaposing like these women's check-ins and photos with this kind of like stripper kind of sex worker availability. And so I could see how that made people uncomfortable. But the call from all the people that were writing about this was like, you need to shut this down. This is privacy invasive. These women don't realize that they're putting this information out there and they're going to get stalked and they're going to get raped. And I just found that really disturbing. And this is kind of like the privacy fear that I was talking about earlier that we in the media often end up pushing. Because these women I'm a Foursquare user and I check in publicly, so I probably would actually show up on this app if I were around whoever was using it. And I think that the women who use Foursquare and the men who use Foursquare are pretty savvy users and at least know if they're setting their privacy settings for showing up just to their friends or showing up publicly. And so I think that the women and men who were being found this way are aware of that possibility and are open to being found that way. And so I kind of felt like the reaction of saying, like, we have to shut this app down is kind of backwards thinking when it comes to technology that I find it kind of disturbing that we are supposed to assume that anyone who uses the app is going to use it in this, like, ugly way because they're looking for a victim. When in fact there are dating apps that are out there already that allow you to find people this way, I don't think it is a use that should be prohibited, but the context of the app itself, I can understand like some of the reaction.
I agreed with you insofar as I think that there is this presumption of naivete among as if everyone who whose photograph was put out there on this app was a victim. And I don't think that that's right at all. I think that a lot of people who tend to share things publicly on the web wouldn't be at all disturbed. At the same time, I think that a lot of people would be disturbed because it's very easy in the technological realm to put information out in a certain context and have just a small change radically alter your perspective on it. I can imagine someone, for example, who has a Flickr account and takes tons of photos and allows geotagging on the photos because they like the idea of people being able to come and use the software that stitches together different people's photos to create panoramas in various areas, right? So it's easy for me to imagine a photographer who does geotagging and finds it useful for her own photos and finds it useful for this cool collaborative thing that people do, and yet would not feel very good about it if there were someone who came up with an app called Lady Photographers and broadcast, you know, her information when she was going on shoots in, you know, like remote nature locations or something. And I don't know, it just seems like the Girls Around Me app was that kind of thing. For some of the users, it was, I put my information out to be used in this context, and it was used in this other context. And by this other context, I don't just mean a site with naked silhouettes around it, but just, just the dating context is different, right, than the Foursquare context. You made what I thought was a very astute point, maybe it was, I can't remember actually if this was you or someone that I found talking about your article, but the point was that that dating sites, that a lot of people use Facebook, right, for dating.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it isn't labeled a dating site is very important to people because there's this different way that people react, right? And I think that it's the same thing with this Girls Around Me thing. These are people who would, there are some people who would not have agreed to opt into a dating site who right. were sort of opted into one. And despite the fact that they put out all of the information that was then broadcast and willingly shared it publicly, they willingly shared it publicly in a non-dating context. And I don't really know how you, I don't really know how you figure out the etiquette around these things.
Right.
Because there are all sorts of ways where the information that people put out is, you know, useful or cool or beneficial if you tweak it in some other way.
Right.
And it isn't feasible to go and get individual consent for every conceivable thing you might do with this. For example, stitching photos together into a big panorama. I don't know. I guess.
Yeah, it's a complicated. If this app had just been people around me, and it was just a kind of like get to know who's in your area, you know, see which bars are hopping.
Right.
I think it would have, and there are apps that like that out there. I don't think it would. It might have like raised concerns among some really protective. Privacy folks, but I think most people would have been fine with it. And I do think it's a valid point that the context change bothers people. And that if you are deciding to be, part of Grindr or part of Blender, that you have opted into the dating app aspect of it. I there's not really, as far as I know, an easy way for these apps to say, are you okay with being part of this app? It would have to come from, Foursquare or Facebook to decide how to kind of divvy out their data. And I just worry. I think that is too restrictive in terms of really good uses of these technologies. So I don't know. I mean, my kind of feeling is that there will be a few bad apples, like Girls Around Me, and then there will be pushback, and then they will, change how they're using the information, or they will die the death that Girls Around Me is gone. Foursquare shut down their access to the API, and shortly thereafter, they pulled their app from the iTunes Store, and then the company that was funding them, iFree, said, we're not giving them any more money, and we're, like, completely pulling away from this.
Right.
So I don't know if people figure out kind of figure out these kind of tricky context issues on their own as some things fail and some things yeah. succeed. Or if we have to come up with, I mean, this is something that is in the most recent kind of privacy white papers to come out of the Department of Commerce and the Federal Trade Commission, that that various kind of companies using information need to respect the context in which the information is collected, and then you only reuse that information in the same context.
But yeah, the larger, I guess the larger question for me, that, and I don't know the answer to it, is whether we're headed for, whether we're now in a period of disruption when new norms are developing and we're eventually going to settle on new norms, or whether we're just constantly going to be facing innovation and changing norms and many generations that have used technology in different ways, and there are just never again going to be settled technology norms, or at least settled technology norms that last for longer than, you know, 3 years or that transcend generations. And I guess
I think the norms could just change dramatically. I mean, I think there will be a time when, right now, facial recognition just completely freaks us out. The idea of somebody being able to walk down the street and look at us and know who we are and vice versa just seems like too invasive to us. But I kind of feel like as more people are using apps like Foursquare and announcing where they are, that we're getting more comfortable with kind of projecting our identity all of the time. I could imagine this being something, I mean, you could opt in and opt out, but I don't know that in 10 years it will be strange to be walking down the street and be identifiable to a stranger.
So I guess zooming back, is it your general contention that privacy is just doomed, that we are no longer going to be able to be private people in anything like it was conceived, you know, 5 years ago?
No, I am not on the privacy is dead camp. Which I see all the time. I mean, if you can go back 20 years and find these like privacy is dead, why privacy is dead now. And so privacy is either a vampire or a zombie that just keeps coming back to life when people have declared it. DOA. I just think that privacy is kind of going to continue to, I don't think it's doomed, but I think it will change. There are things now that we just don't consider private in the same way. I think Facebook would have been maybe horrifying to people 30 years ago, but now we're really comfortable with like having a kind of persona out there that is accessible to any person at any time if they know your name. And I just think in that way, privacy will continue to change, but we'll still want information that is kept private in certain contexts. Information that is kept back from certain people, and we're just going to have to find kind of new technological means to do that. But yeah, I do think privacy norms will absolutely continue to change as new technologies change the way that information flows.
I wonder if one change that we're going to see is that the way people keep private is going to change from walling off data about themselves to flooding the zone with data. I keep thinking that we're soon going to see a company, maybe one already exists, that, you know, you'll sign up for this company and they'll sign into your Google account and they'll just Google all sorts of things. They'll Google innocuous things, they'll Google offensive things, and what this will offer you is plausible deniability for the entire future, right? Because when someone comes along and says, oh yeah, Google got hacked by these people that released this data, and look, you were searching for this and that and the other thing, you'll say, oh no, I'm one of the many clients of this company that Googles all sorts of random things at random intervals, and so you have no idea if what I typed into the box or what they typed into the box, you can't distinguish between the two.
What about the security risk, though, of giving that company access to your account?
Yeah, there's totally a security risk. It's totally a trade-off. But I think there are all sorts of areas where you can imagine this sort of thing, right? I mean, if a friend came to me and said, you know, yeah, I don't, you know, I was caught in a photograph doing this really embarrassing thing or doing this really awful thing, right? And there's no way to get it off of the internet now. It's just everywhere. You know, maybe the right thing for that person is, Photoshop himself into various compromising things and create a whole meme around it. And, you know, a page where someone else is saying, yeah, I'm going to Photoshop you doing offensive things, and like, create a whole alternate universe that just floods the zone with data so that you can't know what's real anymore. And it seems like that's going to be the only solution for people who are embarrassed or have some piece of information out there that would embarrass them or would discredit them. And I think a lot more people are eventually going to take that approach. That they're going to be forced into a world where, because of other people, they can't control their own privacy settings, and the only thing left to do will be to create fictions around themselves.
I have seen this idea floated around only by individuals. Somebody who says that, like on Facebook, she puts in a lot of false information just so Facebook doesn't actually know her. I put false birth dates into almost like every site that I use. But the current approach, as I'm sure you know, is to do the information flood, but with like positive stuff. So you can hire a reputation defender to create a whole bunch of sites to kind of push down the negative content.
Right.
One problem I think is that technology kind of keeps up with subterfuge. So even if you did this, I think you could tell, there would probably be ways to identify who was signing in at any given time. So they'd say, oh, well, you have these three Google searches that are pretty incriminating and they came from your IP address. Whereas you have these like other, five that you're pointing to as proving you innocent, they come from someone else. So from some other IP address?
I mean, you're certainly right that technology, you're certainly right that there's a sophistication that would be a constant arms race if this kind of thing were to take hold. But I also think that sometimes it doesn't have to be sophisticated enough to really fool someone. I mean, for example, say you're coming out of college and you're getting a job and you know that if an employer Googles you, they're going to see something that you don't want them to see. It seems like one thing you could do, right, is to create an internet identity for a separate person that shares your name, right?
Right.
So you create a Facebook profile for them. You create a history for them. You make it look in various ways so that it's this other person who is the one who did this bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all you would theoretically, like, it's not that it would be very hard to do to the level of, a private investigator is looking into this. Can you fool him? But it would be much, much easier to do if it was just someone is going to do a cursory Google search for my name when they're about to hire me. And so I think that even with the technological challenges, I just bet that this is something that's going to happen in big ways and small. And I wish I knew. I wish I knew what the commerce side of it was going to be, because I would start that company now. But alas, I don't. I am but a humble journalist who cannot code.
The other option is that we all just start living like really staid lives and never do anything bad, or that as a society we become more accepting of these kind of like strange things that happen in people's lives. But. I could imagine your kind of a reputation muddying service
right.
potentially working out.
Right. Yeah. We'll see.
One thing I want to say regarding the norms that we were talking about earlier is something that a lot of the kind of anti-privacy community points to now in terms of this is caller ID, and that when caller ID was first being established, the privacy was first being introduced as a feature, privacy advocates completely freaked out and said it was horrible. Every time you called somebody, they would know who you were, that this was like a really terrible invasion of privacy. But it came into fruition, and now the idea of being kind of identified every time we call somebody is an expectation. And we would almost see it I almost feel like it's a violation of my rights every time I see unknown number flash on my phone, and I don't know whether it's going to be a PR person or, you know, a source who actually has something interesting to tell me.
You're not alone in this. I mean, I am constantly amused by my mom will get, you know, an unknown number at my parents' house. It flashes on the TV screen because their phone and their cable are like in the same package. So if someone calls and the TV is on, it'll say, you know, anonymous is calling, which also always amuses me because I like to think that my mom is for some reason talking to computer hackers trying to take down the global elite. But no, so, you know, it's like anonymous is calling and she won't answer if it's anonymous. And she gets very bothered by the idea that I would answer. Even though for, you know, the first 25 years of my life, that was all that ever happened. Mm-hmm. Everyone was anonymous. But in a very short amount of time, there was this idea of a right to others not having that privacy. And I think you're totally right that expectation has changed. Is there anything else you wanted to get to? My list is through.
I don't think so. This is like a good solid
indeed
hour of privacy talk.
Yes, we have given the people lots of privacy talk, and I enjoyed it. We should do it again sometime. We'll keep an eye on your blog, and when there's lots more privacy stuff to talk about, as there always is, hopefully you'll come back on.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for the invitation, Connor.
All right, thank you.